And good afternoon, and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I am Laurent Landis, here with Josh. Patty Feek is gone this week, and we have the always lovely Leslie McMurray filling in for her. And our guest today is Gretchen Maines. But we also just want to put together a warm welcome back to our wacky, lovable host, David Tappet. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
We missed you.
Yeah, I felt funny not coming in last Sunday, but I couldn't.
Of course you couldn't.
I just couldn't. For those who didn't hear, if you aren't listening last week or didn't see me on television, if you turned the TV on over the last week, Brian, my husband, we were married last June 8th, and he died on March 6th, mm-hmm. just very suddenly.
Well,
the funeral was 6, 7, 8, 9, the 11th, and I got back to work this week. The reason I was on the news so much was when I realized he wasn't breathing, I called 911, and it took 20 minutes to get through.
20 minutes.
I called at 9 o'clock. I didn't speak to an operator until 20 after. At first, I called, and I got the message that your call is very important to us, so please hold on the line. It didn't tell me that if this is an emergency to call 911, because I was calling 911.
Right.
But, my call was very important to them, so important that it dropped. And so I called right back, got the recording again, and I didn't get through to an operator till 9:20. I mean, at that point, once I got through to the operator, I said, I need an ambulance. She switched me right over. The paramedic said, I said, I need an operator again. I need an ambulance. They said, let me verify your address. I verified it. And she said, okay, an ambulance is on its way. Now stay on the line with me. And was just talking me through. But for 20 minutes, I was doing chest compressions and mouth-to-mouth.
Were you on a cell phone or a landline?
Yes, it was a cell phone, and I had the cell phone next to the bed on speakerphone.
Yeah.
So I wasn't even touching the phone. It's not like, you put it up to your ear, and it touches the wrong part of the screen, and it was on the night table.
Yeah.
This is the second death that could be a direct link to the failure of our 911 system here in Dallas. There's also an infant that died, 4 or 5 days after Brian?
Yeah, after that Saturday night, I think.
Yeah, okay. And so, watching the news, we hear a lot of, finger pointing, or see a lot of finger pointing. The city of Dallas is pointing the finger at T-Mobile, and that the system was flooded with all these ghost calls from T-Mobile. T-Mobile is pointing the finger at the city of Dallas, saying that their system is flawed with its old system. So, what have you heard? Because I know you went to a press conference.
Yeah, I went to a press conference, and all the TV reporters are trying to get their question in because they can't take somebody else's question. It's better if you have your own question. Usually I'm real polite at these press conferences, and I only ask a question when other people aren't. But this time I wasn't going to have it. Mike Rawlings knew Brian, and I wanted this real personal. And I knew none of them had a personal story, so I just said, excuse me, but on Monday, and I told the story. And I could see Mike Rawlings' mouth just, his face just dropped. And I made it personal for him. So I'm not blaming him.
No.
He's furious over this. He doesn't know how to fix phone software.
Right.
Yeah.
If nobody told him that we have some equipment that's antiquated, why would he know? He was furious over this. So I'm, no blame in that case.
Is it limited and also, to let's point Dallas out Dallas City, or is it Dallas County? Is it more widespread?
911s are cities.
Okay.
Yeah. It's connected right into your fire department, to your local police department. All those are city-run things.
Well, a lot of them are county-run, though, if they're unincorporated.
If they're unincorporated, it would be, yeah. And there's probably a separate 911 system for that. But, Mesquite has its own 911 system. They're not contracting with each other. Each city throughout the entire country has a 911 system. So here's where I don't believe them.
Well, that's where it makes it more complicated if you have a cell phone, because I have a 214 area code on my cell phone, but if I'm down in Waco and call 911, it has a 214 area code, but I'm not in Dallas.
No.
But I think it'll pick up off of the transmitter wherever the
tower,
you are.
It goes tower, by the yes. cell tower.
Yeah.
The cell tower is programmed to get it to the local 911.
So if even though I live in Dallas County, if I'm in Garland where I live, it's going to go to Garland.
Oh, about 7-8 years ago, I had an accident coming back from Austin, and it was like in Belton. Yeah. And I dialed 911, and I got the local police. Anyway, so here's what they're saying is wrong. First of all, they're saying 911 was a little bit understaffed, and they hired 12 operators for positions. Okay, Dallas has been growing. If you live in Oak Lawn or several other parts of the city, you know it is. Traffic is miserable compared to what it was a year ago. Dallas is growing. You know, we have a traffic jam, and you see it, and it's obvious. You know, we really need a traffic light there, but it's not obvious. You know, we have more people here now. More people mean more 911 calls means we need to hire operators. Maybe somebody should have thought of that. I get how that's not the thing that you think about. Right?
Yes. Yeah. And it's also very important to consider that the people who are calling 911 are people who feel that their lives are in danger or that someone else's life is in danger. And it's really important to have a system that you can trust when you're in that state of mind.
You're calling probably for one of three reasons. You need the police for an emergency, a robbery, a murder, an attack, or something. And there was an attack downtown.
There was.
And they tried calling 911 and couldn't get through. They're okay. But you're calling for police. You're calling for fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, imagine your house is burning down and you're on hold for 20 minutes. Everybody's going to be dead.
Mm-hmm.
Or you need paramedics because you're having a medical emergency. Now, I'll tell you, and I'll say it as many times as I have to, once those paramedics were dispatched, they were at my place in 3 minutes flat. They were working on Brian and transported him to Parkland. Service in Parkland emergency room was fabulous. Interesting story. How are you related? Because they need to know, especially if the person doesn't live. I said, I'm his husband. And they asked me, were you legally married? I said, yes. Didn't ask me to provide any paperwork. Just asked me if I was legally married as a matter-of-fact question. And
it kept moving.
When I said I was, I'm next of kin, and they went on with the paperwork. They were as professional as could be, but they were compassionate. And, Parkland is such a technological wonder. It really is. They had any and all equipment available there. Now, had Brian gotten to that equipment an hour earlier, who knows? So, but and the thing is, we don't know.
Yes.
Not that I'm saying he would have made it through. The doctor even thinks what happened at home might have just played out at the hospital. So, but nobody else should have to go through this
right.
Because for those 20 minutes, I was frantic.
Of course,
you
that
were.
Had seemed like 2 hours, not 20 minutes.
Each minute right. seemed like an hour. Each minute, you know, when the paramedics came, they started doing compressions.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're doing them, these are like six burly men came into the apartment. They're switching off every 2 minutes. I was at it for 20 minutes.
Yeah, and you blow away in a strong breeze.
Uh-huh. It's not possible to keep up with the pace and the rate and what you need to do
right.
for 20 minutes. Because they couldn't do it, and they're trained to do it. And I think some of them were probably younger than I am.
Probably. I think
maybe.
So.
Yeah.
And David.
That's for sure.
You were in a traumatized state of mind. So what you could do in your normal state of mind looks quite different when you're in a traumatized state.
Oh, the adrenaline was running. There's no question there. But it just normal CPR. You do it in 2 minute rotations, not
yes.
20 minutes. And, you know, I think I got a breath several times, but I couldn't sustain it.
Right.
So
what did at the press conference, did they offer any, or even since the press conference, have they offered any advice? What do you do when you're calling and you can't get through? What are we supposed to do, citizens? Did they say anything about that?
Don't hang up. And I said, excuse me?
Don't hang
up. I didn't hang up.
So just sit there
okay,
with
so
the business
here's,
signal.
Here's what T-Mobile has found with their calls. If you're calling in on the T-Mobile network, it dials in on the 4G network. If you don't get through, it dials back thinking it just didn't get a connection on the 3G network. If your call drops because it dropped you or you hung up and said, well, that's not possible, I'm just going to call back again, you're calling back on the 4G network, and when you don't get through, it dials again on the 3G network, and that counts as four calls, and they have to call back each call, even if they're calling the same call four times, which wastes a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Wastes a lot of time. That's weird. That is weird. Of course, you know,
they've suspended that system.
Yeah, I don't know the technicalities of how phones work in that way, but I would think once a phone is disconnected, when you hang up, it's just disconnected, period.
But
from all of the
it
G's.
Records, if you dial 911, it records that you've dialed 911, and they will call back to make sure that you weren't in some situation where you had to hang up.
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah,
but
that
if it's
part
the same
makes
number,
sense.
You don't need to speak to that same person four times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a little redundant.
Mm-hmm. For some reason, it's not putting them together. I think now it is.
Yeah.
That part of it, I think they got worked out. Here's my question. It does this. Just in Dallas? Mesquite's not having that problem. Atlanta's not having that problem. Washington, D.C. is not having that problem.
Right.
You can use T-Mobile in any of those places. So why just in Dallas?
Right.
Might
and
I also add, smaller cities are not having that problem.
Right.
And where is T-Mobile's headquarters?
Here.
Right here in Dallas.
Question, has anybody said how long they have known about this problem?
Since November. Possibly October.
And they haven't fixed it. Is it that it hasn't been a priority or that they've been trying things?
I guess because I have a big mouth.
I guess so.
Well, it's like somebody said, it's
going
to take somebody to die.
They know it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately. And now two people have passed. Mm-hmm.
Yes, because it's really important to understand that when our brains have been traumatized, which is the state of mind that, David, your brain was in,
mm-hmm.
2 minutes can feel like 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
The part of our brains that actually tell us what time we're in right now and knows kind of future and past and can put all the pieces together of time, that part goes offline when we're traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
So people may not even know how long they're on hold or they're having to call
right.
back.
Good point.
They might not realistically know what that looks like.
You know, and the only reason that I know the time is because on my cell phone it has the time there and I was watching
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, that's 2 minutes. Okay, it's 3 minutes. Okay, it's 5 minutes. And I'm getting more and more frantic over the time.
Yes, absolutely.
So
because what we don't want, and I know this happened in the situation with the infant that passed, is it people trying to lift bodies and get in the car and get frantic and try and take the people that they're trying to get to medical care and rush them to the ER by themselves.
I would have done that if Brian was walking around like he was a couple of hours earlier.
Yes.
I would have done that because we live so close to
you
Parkland.
Do. You do.
So.
But that's what happened in the case of the infant that died.
Mm-hmm.
The mother, she never got through to the 911. At least you got through eventually. She never got through. And eventually had to rush the little boy to the hospital, and he passed anyway.
So
that's horrible.
While they're monkeying around with the system, what is their advice to people? Just don't hang up.
Don't hang up.
It takes 20 minutes. It takes 20 minutes. Oh, well, sorry?
Yeah, just sit there and hold on and listen to a busy signal?
Not a busy signal. A recording that says your call is very important to us.
Yeah.
Please do not hang up.
That's right, you said that. Yeah.
Mm. And I'm glad the recording kept playing because that's how I knew I hadn't been hung up on.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that is absolutely
it didn't
thing.
Say.
That's not good enough.
Nope. You know, okay, so they hired some more operators.
Now, how many do they typically have? I mean, is 12 like doubling their staff or is 12 like adding.
You know, I think right. they're strategically placing them during hours that are busier. 9 o'clock on a Monday evening shouldn't be one of those busy times. Saturday night, sure. You have accidents. You have all kinds of things like that. People are drinking more.
Right.
9 o'clock on Monday night. That's not the busy
rush
time.
Hour, yeah.
That's not rush hour.
So aside from hiring more staff, have they did any
okay, so,
temporary
fixes?
Okay,
so T-Mobile has temporarily disconnected that 3G, 4G thing.
Good to know.
They looked at our equipment. The equipment, the 911 equipment, had been upgraded in 2011. I get it with phones that if it's more than 3 days old, it's out of date. I get that. But 2011, how many cities upgrade their equipment once a year? You just don't do it. While they identified some antiquated equipment, it's possible when they upgraded at that time, they didn't take everything, just rip it all out, put all new in. There might have been some older pieces there that now do need to be replaced. And if we do need to replace some equipment, let's do it. But I can't believe Dallas is the only city that has equipment that's a little bit older, because we're not hearing that this is happening in other cities.
I was going to say, I wonder what it's like down in Houston, which is almost double the size of Dallas. So, hadn't heard any problems.
Is Houston this technological wonder when it comes to the 911 system?
They have T-Mobile also.
Or do they have three times the number of 911 operators because they know their system doesn't work?
Right.
Yeah, I'm not buying this whole story. Why only Dallas?
Yeah.
And like on CNN, they brought out a story about a couple of glitches that happened in Atlanta. This isn't a glitch. This has been going on since October.
Right.
And it's been getting worse and worse. That's not a glitch.
Yes, this is absolutely a systemic issue.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe there's additional software problems. T-Mobile is looking for it. Part of what I'm not getting is, why T-Mobile and, you know, not AT&T?
Or Verizon. Right.
Now, this is one of those things. This is public safety. This isn't a competitive issue. Ooh, I'm on T-Mobile because I like their connection to the 911 system. You know, whoever said that?
Right.
Nobody ever. They need to just share their software and fix this.
Whoever's got the best stuff, let's use that. Yeah.
I haven't heard a problem with Verizon.
I haven't either.
Or Sprint. AT&T has had some problems, but I think they fixed them. But we can't get a straight answer on that.
Well, it's also not something you can test. You know, you don't want to sit with your AT&T phone and dial 911 to see how long it takes to have them answer the phone to say, oh, I was just checking
how
long it takes in case something really horrific happens. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. So, but they have ways of testing it to see whether the calls are going right through.
Maybe they do, but I haven't heard any publicity about them testing it and what the results are.
You know, for that reason, so that people don't start doing it themselves, Well, I'm going to take it into my own hands and see.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just, to me, as this is happening, what goes through my mind is, well, what would happen if? And what are the reasonable expectations? What are they telling you is the normal time to be on hold or waiting for a 911 operator? I mean, just 20 minutes is completely and totally unacceptable.
We need to take a break. Before we go, one of our former guests, one of our regular guests, sent flowers. You know who?
Who?
Eddie Bernice.
Yes.
Wasn't that sweet?
It was very sweet.
I mean, that just made my day that day when she sent them. So.
That's awesome.
You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laron Landis. The late Patty Fink is running very, very late, so Leslie McMurray is here with us. And our guest is Gretchen Manis. We're going to get to Gretchen more right after the break. We're going to talk a little bit about grief.
This is Rollins Gelland, and I'm listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3. And darn glad to be doing it.
Hi, this is Valletta.
All right, Living in Sticks Music Festival, Need Peace Ranch between Fort Worth and Austin. Nooner Pine with other acts to be announced on April 22nd. This is a benefit concert for soldiers who are returning and wounded Vietnam vets. So,
Iraq War vets.
Iraq War.
You old people just still living in the Vietnam era.
And that's going to be on April 22nd. For directions or ticket information, call 254-727-5069. Again, 254-727-5069.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here with Ron Landis and Leslie McMurray. Our guest is Gretchen Maness. And yes, Gretchen Maness is Josh Maness or Chris Maness's... He's schizophrenic. Leslie is looking at me, but...
It's got two different A's.
His
sister. Gretchen is a counselor. And for anybody who didn't hear the beginning of the show, Brian, my husband, for 9 months, passed away on March 6th. If you listened to our November Pledge Drive show when we played the newlywed game, Brian and I won, right?
But it was a good learning experience about
you're laughing because...
You cheated.
We didn't cheat, but we also didn't get any points.
I think you got one.
We got one of them.
I think you won one round, you got one point.
Yeah, Candy and Candy Markham and her wife... They just knew each other.
They did, but
just as they've been together for 45 years.
Right, but they didn't win either.
Oh, that's right. It was Patty and Aaron.
Patty and Aaron who won.
Right.
See, I needed Danny on the show. We would have cleaned up, I think.
Anyway, so that was the last time Brian was on the show. Yeah. And he died very suddenly. We think stroke or heart attack. So Gretchen, tell us a little bit about the type of grief counseling that you, or the type of counseling that you do, and some of it is grief counseling.
Yeah, I work at a private practice here in Dallas, and I see children, adolescents, and adults who have been through traumatic experiences, and oftentimes that includes people who are currently experiencing grief in their life of a lost loved one.
So... what does grief counseling even look like?
Well, it looks different for different people because the grieving process looks different for different people. But what the core goal of it is to allow the grieving person to sort of have a support system, a place where they can go and they can talk about what their individual experience of grief is, and then come up with ways to cope with the grief they're feeling.
Does one person who's gone through grief a number of times, you know, I lost a number of friends through the AIDS crisis. I've lost both of my parents. My grandfather, the last time I spoke to him, he said, you know, I said, how are you doing? He said, the doctors are standing at the foot of the bed and they said, I have, cardiac arrest, and my liver isn't functioning, and my kidneys aren't functioning. What do they think? I'm deaf? So, you know, my grandfather, he'd be 136 this year had he just lived through that one last illness. But, you know, so I've had different stages or different grieving experiences. Does the same person tend to go through grief the same way when they lose different people?
It really kind of depends on the environment of the loss, so what kind of loss it was. So maybe if you had another loss that was sudden and unexpected, then this current loss might feel similar in some ways. But in general, it is a different process, depending on where you are in your life, developmentally where you are, as well as what relationship you had with the person that you lost.
At Brian's memorial, I was sitting next to Cece Cox with the Resource Center, and Cece made an observation that really hit home with me as we were looking around. It's basically who's who of the LGBT community in Dallas, and she said, not to get dark, but it's just a statement of fact that loss is such a big part of who we are as a community. Certainly in Brian's case, it was, you know, this sudden loss. But so many of us, like you say, you've lost so many people through the AIDS crisis. It's just a part of the fabric of who we are as a group. And it's just, that's something that we do well.
Absolutely. I think there's a certain resilience in the LGBT community because it's had to be that way. It's like you've developed these skills to be able to cope because that's how you've made it this far.
You know, and it's interesting that over the past 2 weeks, at Brian's funeral, I delivered the eulogy, and I can't tell you how many people said to me, I don't know how you did that, Howard. Do you know it was the easiest thing I've ever had to write? I mean, difficult, but easy, you know, it just came right out. It was very easy to write for me.
I refer to those things as things that write themselves.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, jokes and all that I have in there, because my stories with Brian were funny. Mm-hmm. But that was very easy to do. Of course, afterwards, I kind of passed out.
You've done your job. You did it well.
Yeah. And what happened was I passed out, and I have no memory of passing out. I have no memory of feeling.
Really?
Nothing. All I remember is...
All those cute firemen?
No, before that.
Weren't they? I didn't want to go there.
Oh, yes.
No.
I think they're saying things.
All of the doctors that I knew just standing around me, there were like eight of them who were at the funeral.
Yeah, that's the odd thing. You have a Jewish memorial. You say, is there a doctor in the house? What, are you crazy? There's like eight.
Right. And then a whole team of nurses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So.
And lawyers, too, just in case.
Not as many.
So David's been joking with himself all week, you know, saying, you know, he's a media whore, so you got that to add to your resume. So now you're going to add drama queen.
Well, exactly. Neil Cazares-Thomas from Cathedral of Hope called me up afterwards just to make sure I was okay, and I said, Neil, you never made a dramatic exit?
I sent him a note. I said, I just wanted to make sure you're okay because you didn't have the common decency to say goodbye.
Now, let me tell you, if you want the best service possible in an emergency room, bring your own doctors in the ambulance with you.
There you go. Yeah.
The tests that they ordered, those results were back like that. I mean, she walked out of the room, she walked back in, and okay, it's showing such and such levels. And I'm looking and saying, did I pass out again? They said, no, why? Because you just walked out the door with that blood.
Wow.
Of course, one of the doctors that was with me is kind of a smart ass, so they're taking the blood, and he said, huh, that blood's coming out red. David's blood is green. And this poor tech is saying, no, it's coming out the right color.
Doesn't get it.
No.
Poor
well, he's not expecting that
right,
from,
of course, of course.
From a physician.
Right.
So. You know, Josh just said laughter is also a part of grief.
The coping mechanism.
Talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely. You know, when we are grieving, we experience all of the emotions, kind of the whole range of emotions. So oftentimes we allow ourselves to feel some of them, but not all of them. And joy and laughter are so important because they remind us of the gifts that the person gave to us.
Yeah.
Right. I couldn't have told those stories without them being funny. And then I'm talking about the stories that I told about during the eulogy. Because Brian and I had fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it reminds us that it was a whole life that he lived and a whole connection that you had. So we see all of those parts of that.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what's normal and not normal, or what's not normal for some people? It's always, you know, it depends on the person. And I know one of the big topics we've been talking about is food. David got a lot of food. I know that's maybe the American tradition thing to do, probably in most cultures, when someone passes, to bring food over to give nourishment to the family, the surviving family. But also what I have found in me personally and other people is when you have lost someone, you have no appetite. You lose it. So is that normal, or just talk about the normalcies of grieving?
So it's hard for me to say what's normal because I don't think anything is normal or not normal. I will say that when you are in the grief process, especially in the very early stages, your brain is still in that place where it is traumatized, and when you are functioning with a traumatized brain, your digestion slows significantly and your appetite goes away. Mm-hmm. Your breathing takes up a lot more of your energy. Your brain is working very hard to think. That takes a lot of your energy, and food becomes less important during that time.
Now, I'll tell you what, the first day after, because he died Monday night, I didn't tell anybody other than one person in my office that I wouldn't be coming in for the week. But I didn't tell anybody till Tuesday morning, because by the time I got home, it was midnight. It was, I got that first day 500 messages at least, in between Twitter messages and Facebook messages and emails and phone calls and text messages. I couldn't keep up with it. But everybody was telling me, you need to eat. I had one friend who came over, and he was looking in on me every day. He wasn't worried about whether or not I was eating. He was worried about what I was keeping down.
Yes.
You know, another question would be the importance of sleep, because you certainly want to get enough rest and be able to process that. But I guess in the realm of normal versus abnormal, is where's the fine line between grief turning into depression and then saying, I need to treat this depression while honoring the grief?
Absolutely. Grief can certainly turn into depression, but that's a process, and that does take some time for that to happen. So the way that you can help yourself to not slide into the depression arena is to really attend to what you're feeling when you're feeling it. So when the sadness comes up, stopping and just kind of pausing and being with the sadness, or when the anger comes up, being with the anger. So that is how you can help yourself, because really what depression is it is sadness that we have not expressed. So sadness over time that we hold inside becomes depression.
So basically, if you feel like crying, cry.
Absolutely.
Oh, I didn't cry much on Monday night at the hospital. It just wasn't coming. I was in shock.
Yes.
Of course.
Tuesday it started, but then until the funeral, I went through some waves where I was just sobbing uncontrollably. And you know one of the things that set me off? And this still upsets me, and he's still upset. Brian's cat, and I say Brian's cat, that it was a one-person cat. He saw me doing the chest compression, so he saw me hitting Brian, and then he saw the paramedics carry him out of the apartment. That cat has been wailing and sobbing, and he has been just crying for the last 2 weeks.
Well, he hates you.
Do you know, twice so far he's curled up with me because he just needed some attention, mm-hmm. but he is a one-person cat. He is Brian's cat.
I am so glad you said that, because animals do this so naturally and beautifully, which is to express how they're feeling when they're feeling it. They don't push it down or repress it in some way, pretend it's not there. They just express it. Mm-hmm. And once they express it, it gets out of their systems, and then they're free to move forward with their lives.
It hasn't gotten out of his system yet. He was just, I thought he was getting better.
Yes.
And this morning he was just wailing again.
So this is a really important point. This is a wave of grief. And oftentimes people think when they're grieving that it should be linear, and that as time progresses, things should just get better. And that's absolutely not the way that it works. It works much like the ocean. At times there's calmness, and at times there are waves. And it sounds like the cat was experiencing a recent wave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
sometimes there's big waves.
Yes.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting, though, his memory and his thought processes? I get what he saw. You have to strip out all of the, you know, human layer on it. All he saw was me hitting Brian. So that not only was his person injured, mm-hmm. but he saw me doing it.
Yeah.
And he was connected enough to Brian to know what Brian's, like if Brian was already gone, mm-hmm. or kind of what Brian's state was, mm-hmm. the cat understood that in a non-language kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's...
Again, I know we're about to go to break in a few minutes, but if you could talk a little bit about, I don't know, I've heard people say, oh, it's been 6 months or a year at the loss of a loved one. You should be fine now. And it's not always the case. You know, people grieve at different rates. And again, from personal experience, I don't know if you really actually ever get over it. You just learn to live with it.
I think that's absolutely true. I don't think you ever get over it. But like you said, you learn to cope with it. You build some resilience and some you're able to kind of shift and see the gifts that you received from the person and then do things with those gifts, kind of proactively doing things, and that's helpful, but you never really get over it.
Yeah, I've heard, to use the wave or ocean analogy, is that when something is fresh and it first happened, it's like getting swamped by these 100-foot waves, and as soon as the one washes over you, the next one comes, and you feel like you're drowning, and it's pretty hopeless. But eventually, those 100-foot waves kind of stretch out, and they become 50-foot waves. And every once in a while, you get clobbered by a 100-footer again, but eventually those diminish out. And it's just occasionally you'll get the sneaker wave when something will come up, but overall it kind of smooths out.
And the important thing is to be like the wave and to just allow it to come when it happens.
Be like a surfer and just ride the wave.
Just allow it. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, talk about this a little bit. The whole first year can be difficult because, you know, holidays that you celebrate, there's Brian's birthday is in 2 weeks. That's going to be terrible. Not just for me, but his parents and his sister and brother and an aunt who's been calling me regularly. Brian's family's been wonderful. They've just been calling and making sure that I'm okay, and I've called them making sure they're okay. But events like that, our wedding, we didn't get to our first anniversary, so we didn't get to celebrate an anniversary, and we have a piece of the wedding cake sitting in the freezer. I don't know what to do with it, whether to keep it and have it on that date. I mean, I'm not rushing to throw it out, but or do I don't do that? Because is that healthy? Is that not? I don't know that there's an answer.
Yeah, I think it really is just important that you're open to whatever the answer is when it comes to you. So I can't tell you how to grieve, and I can't tell you what to do with that piece of cake. But you'll know, and when you know, you'll be able to do that.
Well, we have a few months
to
even think about it. But that one's a difficult one.
Yes, and also it's important that you're saying that because the anticipation of it can be as stressful as the actual event of the, you know, the one-year anniversary of something like this. So sometimes the anticipation and the anxiety that we get can be very as stressful as some of the feelings, other feelings that we're experiencing.
One of the other things, and we just have 1 minute, one of the other things is sometimes some things have happened that seem very unimportant that are the things that are setting me off. You know, big things. Oh, sure, I'll go on CNN and whatever and talk about our 911 system. We need to get it fixed. You know, people have asked me, well, how are you being so strong? Because it's given me something to do. That I know is important. We need to just get the 911 system fixed. It's not about me suing the city. I'm not, you know, it's not about me being angry at the city or I just don't want other people to go through what I went through, which was being frantic for 40 minutes or for 20 minutes. Why don't we take our break? Because I want to explain this one a little bit. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, this is Valetta Bell, and I listen to Lambda. I hope that you will too.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Ron Landis and the early Leslie McMurray.
On time, punctual.
The punctual Leslie McMurray. Our guest is Gretchen Maness. We have a city thing I want to get to, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes, Leslie.
Yes.
Because it's a biggie. But we're just talking about how to grieve. Okay, and I remember this when my mother died also. It was odd things that would set me off. So here was one. The cat food. Cat's an older cat, and he's on a gentle formula that only one particular grocery store carries. I cannot stand that place. I can never find anything in it. I can't stand their self-checkout. I can't stand that you have to have a card in order to get the best price there. I don't want to be a member of their damn store. I just don't. For a while, I was just collecting cards. I'd say, okay, give me a card. They give me a card. Do you want to put your information in? I said, no, I'm just adding this to my stack. That store just...
Such a curmudgeon.
Plus their gun policy, I don't like it. And you know what? They want to have that gun policy where they welcome everybody with open carry in their store. Fine. I don't need to be in that store. People who want to carry guns in the store, which is in Dallas, nobody. Fine. I like going elsewhere. I can only get this cat food at that store.
Sometimes I like to shoot my own turkey for Thanksgiving. Is that a crime?
No.
In Dallas city limits, I don't know.
It does tear up the freezer in the Kroger.
Anyway, how normal is it? I know that's not an important thing, but I'm thinking, damn it, Brian, you're the one who went to this particular grocery store, and I go to Aldi.
Those are the real life, day-to-day events, and that is when this is going to come up for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to come up when you're doing what you would normally do in your life with Brian, and this is different. So it's certainly you're angry, and you have every reason to be angry. So it's your anger with Brian for leaving and your anger with having to go to that grocery store you did not want to go to.
Mm-hmm. You know, other things that I'm thinking when it's time for an oil change. It's real easy. He drops me off at my office. I live 2 miles from the office. Drops me off at the office. He goes to our service station, which is right down the street from us. Drops the car, walks home. An hour or two later, walks back, picks up the car, picks me up at the end of the day.
You're so spoiled.
I'm going to have to, well, but it just worked. Yeah. Worked real well.
Right.
And then he had the car for the rest of the day to do other things he wanted to do. I'm going to have to take the car to the service station, put my bike in the back of the car, ride my bike to the office, ride my bike back from the office, which isn't a big deal. It's just 2 miles. It's good exercise.
But it feels like a big deal.
It feels like one.
What if it's raining?
Well, I won't do it on a day that it's raining, but you're right. What if it suddenly starts raining because it's June and it was a beautiful day at the beginning of the day and it's pouring by the time?
I had a question for Gretchen to explore a little bit, because like when you lose a partner, it's somebody who shares every bit of your daily life, knows everything about you, and it's fairly natural or expected anyway to lose parents. But what about kids that are younger that have lost a parent at a young age, where it's really those formative years, 5, 6, 7 years old, where they're old enough to understand that that parent's gone, but not old enough to really deal with it in a mature fashion? And they can sometimes, it can manifest itself, I guess, in either self-harm or in behavioral issues or all kinds of things.
I actually do see quite a few kids in my practice who are grieving a parent. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because developmentally, especially in those years you were talking about, like 4 to 7 years old, what happens is children believe that what happens in the world is because of them in some way. So they sort of think, we call it egocentrism. So they think that if their parent died, that they did or said something that contributed in some way to that. So there's often that sense that they're carrying with them, whether they're aware of it or not, that's contributing to some of the behavioral stuff. And also that sense of not being in control. My life looked a certain way until a certain point. Suddenly it didn't. And so when we see things like cutting, or even use of drugs and alcohol as people get older, that is an attempt to find some sort of control because they've been carrying the sense of being out of control yet responsible.
Do you see some of that in adults?
Sure.
Absolutely.
Because everybody keeps saying to me, now even if you had decided to call 911 an hour earlier, you know, it's not your fault. And, you know, and we were eating dinner an hour earlier.
Yes. So certainly you were going to think to yourself, there might have been something off that I should have taken him to the emergency room for.
And really what we were talking about was, well, maybe you should go to the doctor tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And just have him take a look. But sure, you have those guilty feelings. But I mean, even the doctor in the emergency room, everybody has said to me, nothing you could have done.
Yes, it's a situation that you had no control mm-hmm. over. So the guilt that you might feel is sort of an attempt, a hope that you could have controlled it in some way.
Well, and part of it also, especially as you're going through it and as you putting it through your mind over the next few days. It's not an attempt at blaming yourself. It's sorting out everything, making sure that you understood what was going on. And even if it is does come out as blame in some of the versions, it's just working it through and coming up with the best version that you can come up with for yourself.
Yeah, and that brings me back to the state of mind that your brain was in during the event, and then even days after it, kind of coming out of that cloud of fogginess and trying to really just put the pieces together. So there is that legitimate piece, like what actually
right,
happened.
And when we say fogginess, I passed out.
Yes, you did.
And I'm laughing about that right now because I have no memory of passing out, none, in front of 250 people. You know, I remember waking up and they're telling me, put your legs up. What do you mean put my legs up? The rabbi is doing a service. You know,
I can tell you that there are 250 people that remember it very much.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
I'm sure they do. Did I fall on the floor? What
no,
did I do?
No, you did not.
You just kind of clunked over.
And I was sitting next to Brian's mother, and so I guess she...
Well, I remember sitting there, and I saw your head, because I was behind you, and I saw your head kind of do this. And then the rabbi noticed
rabbi
it, too.
Rabbi said, yeah, David, are you okay?
He stopped in the middle of his sermon, and he said, David, are you okay? And you didn't reply. And then he said, is there a doctor in the house?
And everybody started laughing at that point, because there were so many.
That's how he remembers.
That's how you remember.
That is how I remember. So, give me some of the things that I should look for. Somebody going through grief should look for that are healthy. Some things that you should look for that aren't healthy, because as miserable as grief can be, there you can't avoid it.
Absolutely,
and some of it is healthy.
That is the key to it: to not resist. Or not give into the resistance of avoiding it, because that always makes things worse. So the actual being with the feelings when they come up, no matter what they are, and also talking to someone, having at least one person that you can talk to and that you can trust, and that you know that their focus will be on helping you to get what you need.
And what are some things that aren't healthy?
Things that aren't healthy would be a denial of what happened, or kind of what is, but that would be in a behavioral way. So sort of pretending things were different and drinking away your sorrows, or using drugs, or there's lots of ways that people might try to cut the reality or the feelings off.
Okay.
So what about friends and family? I mean, what can they do? Because they're grieving too, but they're thinking of David, they're thinking of Brian.
It's really important for people who are connected with you, David, to understand that they can offer to bring you food, or they can offer to help you in some way, but you have to be able to say yes and say no when that's appropriate for you.
You know, and with the food, I did have to say, well, I didn't say no. There was so much food, but I couldn't keep a lot of it because I have food allergies that people are not cooking for. So as thoughtful as some of it was, especially when you're sick or going through a period of grief, your food allergies just, they are out of control.
Absolutely.
So,
And how do you approach your friend or your family member who's grieving? Because you do want to help them, but you don't want to overstep your boundaries. You know, just one night, me and another friend of David's were like, well, somebody should stay the night. And I'm like, well, are you going to stay the night? Are you going to stay the night? So, but we didn't want to jump in there and just overstep our welcome.
Yes. When are you providing help, and when are you providing more stress?
Exactly.
And I think it's just a conversation. People are often afraid because they don't know what to say to the person who's grieving. And so they, in their minds, they think, well, what would I want or need? And then they behave in response to that. And actually, if it's more of a conversation where you say exactly what you just said, I want to offer help, I want to do what I can do, and I don't want to overwhelm you.
I had so many people the first week. I had like 10 dinners with 10 different people planned. I don't remember who they were. I went on one. The others just let it fade. But I know because I was counting without writing down who. But we'll get through that. One thing I'm doing that I think is healthy is I have a conference in Orlando on Thursday that goes through Sunday, and I'm staying in Florida for a week and visiting relatives and just getting away a little bit.
Absolutely. So to get connected with people who care about you and you care about, and to get out of the environment where there are so many triggers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gretchen, thank you very much. Leslie, one of the things that we want to squeeze in, we have about 7 minutes.
Well, then let's squeeze.
The city is doing something major.
Yeah, the city is. I'm very proud of them. And
yeah, at a time where we're cutting all health benefits everywhere.
And it's taken a while. It took a while to get this done, but ultimately we received some support from Adam Medrano, who is absolutely fabulous. I mean, he stuck there like a pit bull. He wanted to make this happen. But what we have achieved through having several meetings and a lot of explanations is full transgender health care for city employees, all, 14,000 or so. I don't know how many of them are transgender, but I think there's some that...
All 14,000 of them are going to...
They could be.
Transition now.
I kind of doubt that, but I think, you know, on a serious side, for those that maybe had not come out yet, for fear of I can't afford to do this, it's going to be awkward or expensive or whatever.
Will my employer support me?
Yeah, now.
Well, this says yes.
Clearly and unequivocally, yes, they will. And the initial offer was not correct. There was a lot of half measures in there, and we really stuck by our guns, and they came back, and we got everything we asked for.
And as far as how many people will take advantage of this, when San Francisco began offering it, two people took advantage. So
yeah, it wasn't very many. They had, after 3 years, they'd accumulated $5 million or so in additional premiums, and this was charging about $1.30 per employee per year, and they had only spent about $157,000. So there really isn't a big cost associated with it, but what it is a big giant statement about what kind of city you want to live in.
Yep.
And the other that's so important about this is that people look to Dallas, for well or for ill, people look to Dallas. And so if people are in Lubbock or in El Paso saying, we want to provide a healthcare package for employees that's transgender inclusive, the first question they're going to ask is, well, who else is doing that? And now they can say Dallas is.
Yeah.
And here's an example of what they do, and we can do that here.
And that's the thing. It's not that I expect Lubbock to suddenly be offering transgender health benefits, but until Dallas is offering it, I know they're not going to.
Correct. Absolutely.
One of the discussions that went on about it that I thought was interesting had to do with breast implants and breast reduction.
Yeah, that was one of the sticking points, is they were afraid that if they offered breast reconstruction for transgender women, that every woman that was a city employee was going to rush to get a boob job. And A, that's not going to happen. But B, the point that we made to them is, why would you want to punish a marginalized group of society for something that someone else might do? There's very clear standards of care. For instance, women who've had cancer can get breast reconstruction.
But they can't under the current policy with this city.
Yeah, they can.
They couldn't, I thought.
No, they could. Actually, what was denied under the current policy was breast reductions.
Oh, okay. Oh.
And that was interesting, too, because one of the city administrators said, that's ridiculous. They should. If you have a good employee who is doing right by the city,
having back pain,
and has back and neck pain, of course they should be able to get relief.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things. If it's medically necessary, that should be between the patient and their doctor, not between Cigna and the city. And that's what the transgender health is, because WPATH, which is World Professional Association for Transgender Health, has a very specific set of guidelines called the Standards of Care. And it calls for breast reconstruction in transgender women who have transitioned. So if someone is wanting a boob job and they are not transgender and not someone who's had a mastectomy, then deal with them abusing the system. Don't punish transgender people.
Well, but that's considered cosmetic.
Yes, it is. Well, they were saying that it was also cosmetic with transgender people as well. That was what they were maintaining. And it's not. It's medically necessary.
Because it's cosmetic whether or not your gender?
Yeah, whatever.
Something like that, or it's cosmetic if you've had cancer?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Kudos, hats off to them. Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for that.
City's been working on this for several years, though.
They have.
I think it took having the new city manager to actually take a look at this.
Yeah, he was in our corner. Adam Medrano was in our corner. And to those that were and that stood up for us, I can't thank you enough. I mean, I'm not a city employee. It doesn't affect me one way or the other. But for those that it does, it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. So when is it going to affect?
Now.
Awesome.
It's in effect. They changed the SPDs, and I got the email on Friday.
Hmm. Wonderful.
Isn't that interesting?
Yay.
Gretchen, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Gretchen.
Talking us through a little bit of grief.
Yeah, you didn't hardly cough at all. What's going on?
I don't know. This cough I've had for a month.
Oh, I know.
Yep. The only way I'm talking on the air is, do you know how many packages of cough drops I've gone through?
And thank you for filling in, Leslie.
Anytime.
You'll be filling in for me next week?
Good Lord. Sure. Yeah.
I just need you snarky and...
I know no other way.
Okay, well...
I only come in one flavor.
Good. Well, for all of us here at Lambda Weekly, thank you for tuning in. Usually we're talking about broad issues. Sometimes it gets a little bit personal.
We prefer women's issues.
Okay.
Took me a second. That's cute.
Sometimes it just hits home, but this 911 issue for me, it's very personal, and I'm not doing it for myself. It's not going to change how Brian is, but it could change things for other people in the city. And
I hope so, it does.
Yeah. So we're going to keep following it up this week. And I'll be back in 2 weeks. See you then.